At the intersection of roads and politics, today, January 9th, this is The World. I'm Marco Werman. New Jersey is hardly the only place where the mix of politics and traffic has produced messy results. We'll hear how politicians in Egypt have long been known to set up roadblocks for political reasons.
Messing with the infrastructure of the country, including roads and so on, setting up really annoying checkpoints that made people angry in order to foment discontent.
And speaking of discontent, a former U.S. diplomat and basketball fan weighs in on Dennis Rodman's trip to North Korea.
I find this whole episode of Dennis Rodman embracing one of the most brutal dictators in the world, frankly, disgraceful.
Plus, remembering Sarajevo's shoeshine man, Uncle Misho. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. New Jersey Governor Chris Christie was on all the news channels today, defending himself from a political firestorm of his staff's own making. Christie apologized and fired a top aide, the one whose emails made it clear that Christie's office had ordered the closure of traffic lanes on the George Washington Bridge to get back at a political rival. Christie claims he himself had nothing to do with it. You might say, that is so New Jersey. But it's not just Jersey. Traffic and politics are tightly entwined everywhere around the world. People need to get places, and roads, bridges, tunnels are the lifeblood of politicians. Lagos, Nigeria, for example. I was there a few years ago, and the city's notorious traffic jams, or go-slows, make an average day on the GW Bridge seem positively fluid. And politicians in Lagos know that one of the easiest ways to make constituents happy is to make their daily commute easier. Let's get a taste now of how roads and politics intersect in a few other places around the globe, starting in Egypt.
This is Borzu Deragahi of the Financial Times in Cairo. Many people suspect that under the previous elected government of Mohamed Morsi, the security forces, the police, the judiciary, even some people in some of the public works ministries, were messing with the infrastructure of the country, including roads, setting up really annoying checkpoints that clogged traffic and made people angry in order to foment discontent that would ultimately lead to the overthrow of the government. This sort of manipulation of traffic is prevalent across the Arab world. In Algeria, there's even a show on the radio called Embouteillage, in which people call in and lament the bad traffic they're stuck in. And it's really amazing, some of the stories people tell. Marriages have broken up, jobs have been lost, people have gone insane being stuck in the terrible traffic throughout Algeria. And I talked to the host of the show, and he was explaining how many of the authorities are a little suspicious of his program, because when people call in and talk about traffic, they're not just talking about traffic, they're talking about government competence. And so they're treading a very fine line when they talk about traffic, which has connotations way beyond just getting from point A to point B.
I'm Jerry Haddon in Barcelona, Spain. And here in Spain, politicians from time to time actually build roads that never see any traffic in order to consolidate their empires, at least in the short term. I'm thinking of a particular road that runs 9 miles from the Mediterranean coast in the region of Castellón up to a phantom airport that cost $250 million, which has never seen a plane land. The airport road, it's now a fantastic, sometimes 6-lane wide, state-of-the-art highway that essentially never sees any traffic since the airport never opened. But that highway was built, you know, many people allege, by the political leaders over the last 10 years or so, simply as a means of spreading around taxpayer money among their construction buddies. So the whole project itself is pretty shaky, and that highway still stands glistening in the sun with barely a car moving on it.
I'm Thanasi Kambanis in Beirut, Lebanon. In Lebanon, after the Civil War, they had barely any high-quality roads, and Rafik Hariri, who was the somewhat corrupt billionaire prime minister who rebuilt the city after the war, built this fantastic new highway along the coast, and it went straight to his hometown, which is called Saida, and this beautiful divided highway comes to a crashing halt right in the commercial district of his hometown. And no matter where you're going in South Lebanon, you have to stop in this crazy traffic jam that's every day, weekdays, weekends. And then on the other side of town, the highway picks up, another superhighway, this one built with the patronage of another warlord who's predominant in South Lebanon. And that's how you see the power map. And if you've got a place where the ruler has a country home, then that's where you get a fantastic road. You want a road from the capital to the coastal town in Lebanon where a warlord likes to sail his yacht from.
I'm Ritu Chatterjee, and I'm in Ranchi in the state of Jharkhand in India. I haven't heard of anything quite like the Chris Christie case here in India, although it sounds very Bollywood-like and very Indian in some respects. So here in India, politicians and bureaucrats use what's referred to as the red beacon. It's a light that's put on the top of a car, and you may have seen that in movies, and it flashes, and they also use a siren, just like an ambulance. And while in India, you're likely to see traffic not stopping or making way for an ambulance, very, very often you will see traffic stopping and making way for politicians and bureaucrats in their cars. This is something that's left over from the British times. And while the Brits have left, the people in power in India have seemed to have held on to this privilege. And this has been in the news lately because New Delhi's new chief minister, Arvind Kejriwal, who's an anti-corruption activist, one of the things that he and his party members said they would get rid of is this habit of politicians stopping traffic. And he himself is being watched very closely to see if he keeps up with his promises of getting rid of this colonial hangover, so to speak.
Just a taste of global gridlock from correspondents in India, Lebanon, Spain, and Egypt. Just because it happens everywhere doesn't mean it's okay. The Chris Christie traffic scandal involves commuters from the New Jersey suburbs. Over the past few decades, there's been a boom in low-cost suburbs around cities in Mexico. But now many of those suburbs are falling into disarray, and residents have fled. They've left behind about 600,000 abandoned homes, including 50,000 in Tijuana. From the Fronteras desk, Jill Replogle has a story.
A casual visitor to Tijuana would have little reason to stumble upon a place like Villa del Prado. You get to it by heading southeast of the city's urban core through miles of sparsely populated hills, junkyards, and humble ranches. When you get there, it looks like a small city filled with row upon row of identical one- and two-story units, 14,000 of them. Locals call these types of homes pichoneras, or bird cages, because they're so small. Some are only 300 square feet. But people bought into the idea of having their own home, even if it's a tiny one, in a manicured neighborhood. Ruth Betancourt calls to her three-year-old son, who's gone to play with some neighborhood kids. She moved to Tijuana 8 years ago with her husband and infant daughter. They bought a house in Villa del Prado. When we first got here, it was quiet, Betancourt says. There weren't many people. Most of the houses weren't occupied yet. It was a nice place. That's why we picked it, she says. At the time, those new, empty houses signaled hope, a fresh start in a brand new suburb on the edge of a bustling metropolis. This type of planned development sprang up on the outskirts of Mexican cities starting in the 1990s. There are about 15 in Tijuana. They're modeled on the American suburb, says Larry Herzog. He's a professor of city planning at San Diego State University.
It's often built because of fear of crime. People want to get away from the city. They want to move somewhere where they feel safer.
These suburbs were largely fueled by a Mexican government agency called Infonavit. It finances mortgages for Mexican workers. Infonavit wanted to move beyond the shoddy building and erratic urban expansion that have plagued cities like Tijuana. Over the years, Villa del Prado filled up. Some residents opened restaurants, stores, and internet cafes on the ground floor of their homes. A street market sprung up. But recently, the neighborhood has begun to deteriorate. There are abandoned and vandalized homes on nearly every street. The cul-de-sac where Betancourt lives has four of them. Some are missing front doors and windows. One house is filled with trash. Another has walls covered in graffiti. Betancourt says people get high in these abandoned houses. They sleep in them and keep tabs on the neighbors' comings and goings so they can break into their homes and rob them, she says. The neighborhood built on a dream of safety is now crime-ridden. Here's what happened in Villa del Prado and other low-income suburbs. Like in the U.S., many people lost their jobs when the global economy tanked and could no longer pay their mortgages. But beyond that, some of the developments were built in the middle of nowhere. And though planners expected the city to grow up around the neighborhoods, this often hasn't happened. Here's Larry Herzog again.
Other investors aren't coming in and building shopping centers. There are no clinics nearby. So people are very isolated.
Ruth Betancourt says what drove her neighbors away was crime.
De una se fueron porque se metieron a robar.
She says armed robbers broke into a house across the street. The pregnant woman who lived there was so scared that she miscarried. After that, the family moved to a safer neighborhood. Housing authorities are aware of all of these problems, and they admit they've made mistakes with the suburban model and are now trying to correct them. Alejandro Arregui represents Infonavit in Baja California.
Ahorita la apuesta es hacia otra, hacia una nueva dirección.
He says his agency's new goal is quality of life for the homeowners it serves and quality surroundings. Arregui says the Mexican government is now focused on sustainable housing that's close to where people work, shop, and play. In neighborhoods like Villa del Prado, Arregui's agency is working with private companies and foundations to fix up homes and resell them. One firm has already restored and resold more than 600 homes throughout Tijuana. If the city wants to restore all of its abandoned homes, it's got about 49,400 more to go. For The World, I'm Jill Replogle, Tijuana.
One more quick story before we take a break. It's from Italy. Police there have reportedly been able to decipher a mysterious text, a message that may reveal the details of a secretive mafia initiation process. The words are encrypted in a special alphabet devised by members of the 'Ndrangheta. That's the branch of organized crime base in Italy's far south. The BBC's Alan Johnston has a story from Rome.
The police were investigating a mafiosi murder here in the capital, and they came across three sheets of notepaper that carried a handwritten, coded message. The letters looked like a mix of Arabic, Cyrillic, and Chinese-type script. So two Roman policemen with a passion for crosswords set about the task of trying to crack the code, and they did it. The script is part of the oath-taking process used when new members join a formidable mafiosi clan known as the San Luca. The translated text has a mystical, almost poetic quality. It's rich in symbolism. For example, it talks of a man walking in the sunshine by the sea and then encountering three old mariners who ask him what he seeks. The text describes how you recognize a true mafiosi, a so-called man of honor, and it makes cryptic references to signs and symbols he will have around him. But in the end, the oath-taking rituals are nothing more than an effort to create an atmosphere of mystique and bogus religiosity. There's nothing honorable about those who join the San Luca clan and engage in its violent criminality.
That was the BBC's Alan Johnston reporting from Rome, Italy. Still ahead on The World, if you've got a bicycle, you can centrifuge blood cells on PRI, Public Radio International.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Lumosity.com, the brain training program designed by neuroscientists and used by 50 million people, created to improve memory and attention. More at Lumosity.com. And by Medtronic Philanthropy, expanding access to chronic disease care for the underserved by supporting organizations in communities where they live and work, such as Memphis-based Church Health Center. You can learn more at MedtronicPhilanthropy.com.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. During her life, Venezuelan beauty queen and actress Monica Spear was in the spotlight. But after her murder this week, the spotlight is now on Venezuela's skyrocketing rate of violent crime. Last year, nearly 25,000 murders in the country, according to one group. Spear and her former husband were killed during a robbery while driving on a quiet stretch of highway outside of Caracas. Her death has sparked public outrage and demands that President Nicolas Maduro's government protect its citizens. The BBC's Vladimir Hernandez has been reporting on the story. I want to talk to you about crime in Venezuela, Vladimir, but what is the latest on this case?
Well, the latest of this case is that something probably unexpected happened after the shock of the murder of this couple, is that the political and opposition leaders in Venezuela, in a way, have been brought together and have been even photographed together, trying to agree on security policies to avoid cases like these happening. But it probably was a bit unimaginable that this particular case was going to bring together rival factions, rival political factions in Venezuela, in a country which is extremely polarized.
Right. And in a city like Caracas, where the murder rate is more than 30 times higher than New York City's, I mean, how do people actually live with such a high crime rate?
People just adapt. And in Caracas, many people have stopped doing things that maybe people in other places, particularly like in the US, would you know, consider a bit weird or bizarre. In some areas, for instance, people, when they're driving at night, they would just jump the lights. They would not stop on traffic lights because they're afraid that they may be carjacked, they may be kidnapped, they may become targets for criminals, or other people now carpooling, for instance. Maybe an environmental measure in some cities, but in a city like Caracas, carpooling is more about safety because of the fear of traveling alone. And also, street food used to be very popular a decade ago in Caracas, and not many would, after a party or after even going out, would go to a street stall to get your hot dog or your hamburger or your local beef or whatever, because people are afraid of going out, and that's the way normal life has changed a lot.
I gather even joggers go out in groups.
Yeah, they do. If they even venture to go out and jog, I know of people who have stopped running in parks and public places, well, first because there's not much illumination in some places, and areas that may still be considered safe, then the whole issue of getting your car, going out at night, going for a jog, and then coming back to your area, in a way, I think people are just trying to limit the exposure to the risks of being affected by the criminal violence.
And the demands that the government of Venezuela needs to do more to protect its citizens, is it really just a policing problem?
It's probably more of a structural problem. Many people in Venezuela believe that the police is corrupt and it doesn't really answer the demands of the population. There may be an element of corruption in the police, but also when criminals are actually caught, then they don't really spend that much time in jail because Venezuela has overcrowded jails. So there's not a lot of trust in whether criminals, if they get caught, are going to be prosecuted.
So Nicolas Maduro came to power after the death of Hugo Chavez, and many knew that his biggest challenge was going to be crime, and specifically the murder rate. Does the murder of Monica Spear really bring the murder rate into focus as possibly a political anchor for Maduro?
I think it has, and it may have been surprising for many people in the opposition, the reaction of the Maduro government, in particular because it was quick, it was fast, they came out strongly publicly and in the media to try to give a message that they were doing something about it. They didn't spin it in a way that it has been, in some cases, have been spinned before, because that's what happens in Venezuela most of the times. When there's a problem that is affecting the public, the government takes a defensive mode and the opposition immediately takes it, sees it as a political opportunity. In this case, which is quite unusual, there has been less of a political grab into it and more about just a natural reaction of anger, of shock, and even from within government ranks of people who have been generally seem to be shocked about what has happened.
Vladimir, at a very basic level, do the Venezuelan people trust the police?
I think they don't, and in particular because there are many cases of criminal violence where police officers sadly have been involved, either by kidnappings, either by just crimes. People who have been stopped by men wearing police uniforms, that's not clear if they have been criminals themselves or just policemen doing wrong things, and they have been ended up shot, stuff like that. And this is not just unusual, extraordinary cases. These are things that not only in Caracas, but in all of the country, it has been frequent when there has been an element of police involvement in the crime. So no, the trust levels of the police are very, very low.
The BBC's Vladimir Hernandez, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
One of this week's big news stories was the coming out of a gay professional soccer player from Germany. Thomas Hitzlsperger is his name. He's a former player, actually, just retired. But his announcement was big news because there are so few male pro athletes, active or not, who are openly gay. Hitzlsperger told the BBC that it just made sense for him to wait until now to speak out.
I just decided it's the right moment for me to do this, and not really thinking about the reaction. Of course, I asked people before if it's okay doing this. You know, about 2 years ago, I was almost at the same point where I wanted to speak out. But then I've been warned by several people. They said it's too much while you're playing football and you know, doing all of this. And it proved to be right, because it was hard work. The last couple of weeks I've been extremely busy to prepare myself for today. I can't imagine playing football and doing this at the same time.
Here in the U.S., NBA center Jason Collins made headlines last year, as you may recall, when he came out as gay. Collins was the first active athlete in any of the four major male American sports leagues to come out. He's had trouble finding a team since. Then there was American soccer player Robbie Rogers. He came out as gay about a year ago and quit his pro team in England at the same time. Rogers has since restarted his career here in the U.S. Some have described the atmosphere surrounding the top European soccer leagues as toxic toward homosexuals, but Thomas Hitzlsperger, who played in Germany's Bundesliga and England's Premiership, says he's not so sure about that.
I don't know if football is such a homophobic environment. You know, people just speculate that this will be the case, but since we don't know, we have not really seen a gay football player in the Premiership or in the Bundesliga, it's hard to say that this will happen. We have to wait and see.
Hitzlsperger says he hopes his coming out will help other gay athletes out there, and he hopes that being a gay athlete will one day not be such a big deal. The former German national team player also told the BBC about how he coped with anti-gay humor in the locker room.
A dressing room can be quite a funny place, and jokes are being told, and if the jokes about gay people are funny, I can laugh about it. You know, I don't take it too seriously. But we didn't often talk about it, not the subject. There were speculations and rumors about possible gay football players, but other than that, we didn't have serious discussions about possible homosexuals and how would we react, and you know, how would we react to how would the fans react. That didn't happen. We had other priorities. You know, we got together to prepare ourselves for games, for important games. We got there to get into the team if we weren't in the team, or to progress to a better team or play for the national team. Those were the concerns we had most of the time.
Hitzlsperger's decision to come out has received support from a number of leading figures in world soccer, among them Sepp Blatter, the head of the governing body, FIFA. His statement said in part that, unfortunately, prejudices still exist within the game. You're listening to The World on PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Marco Werman. In Nigeria, a doctor makes medical equipment out of anything.
For me, it doesn't matter what it looks like, as long as it's functional.
And a Congolese musician sings about Africa's lack of progress.
The time is suspended time. That's basically what the song is talking about, like nothing really changed.
Those stories ahead on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston. If you were to take a red marker and color in the African nations at war, the center of the continent is looking like a giant red blotch right about now. We've been telling you about the crises in South Sudan and the Central African Republic lately. Today we want to talk about the Democratic Republic of Congo, a place that's seen its own pitched battles in recent days between rebels and the government. In all three of those countries, the news is discouraging. But this next story reminds us that there are young Africans who are invested in real change and making things better. I want to tell you about one of those young people, a musician from Congo. His name is Baloji. This is Independence Cha-Cha. When it came out, Baloji wasn't even born. Singer Joseph Kabasela wrote it to embrace Congo's 1960 independence from Belgium. Baloji would be born in 1978, when Congo had already become Zaire and was firmly under the thumb of dictator Mobutu Sese Seko. When Baloji was 7, he moved with his dad to Belgium. He got big time into hip-hop, but then he happened to sample a bit of Cameroon's Manu Dibango and reconnected with his own roots. Baloji would go on to record another tune that became huge in Congo. It sampled that 1960 track, Independence Cha-Cha. His version, though, is critical of the lack of progress since independence. La multitude d'origine, autant d'ethnie que de coutume, n'empêche le partage d'aspiration commune. C'est
indépendance. There is so many layers in that song.
To give his song the authenticity he wanted, Baloji told me, he went back to Kinshasa to record it and shoot the video with local musicians.
I went back to Kinshasa because I felt this urge of doing music. And whatever we were doing music, people were always talking about politics.
And what were they saying about the politics?
Just talking about the situation. Just talking about, you know, like a country like Congo has its first election. Can you imagine in 2007? So it's like a revolution. And so I use that angle because the song is talking about that. Basically, like since the independence, we move some small step and we have to accept that it's some small step. So we don't have to lose this idea that we are on the right path. We don't have to lose this because we all know what's going wrong in Africa. Everybody is the easiest target you can get.
As a sort of protest song, which bemoans the lack of progress in countries like Congo, do you think it had an effect? I mean, what is the situation in DR Congo since you wrote the song?
Yeah, it was critical because when we record that song, most of the musicians didn't want to sing on it.
Really?
No. And I changed completely the lyrics for the original version. We took another direction. We questioned what happened next, like saying the clock stopped ticking at midnight. Mm. And then we still, the time is suspended. Suspended time. That's basically what the song is talking about. Like nothing really changed. But still, we had to change slowly because it takes time. And we have to accept that it takes time.
Do people in Kinshasa, in Lubumbashi, listen to your music? And how would you like them to react to it?
Yeah, they start listening to it. It took us a while because, I mean, as somebody is living in Europe, you physically protect it. Mm. You're not confronted to the situation the way they are confronted to. It's also a country where you don't have protest music because there is no record label. The only way for musicians to have recognition is working with beer company or telecom phone companies. So you have to be really politically correct. Mm. You cannot talk about this kind of subject. So nobody talk about this kind of things. So they give me a pass as the fact that I'm a little bit an outsider, but I'm 100% Congolese and I'm representing the Congolese flag. It's my identity. And I don't have this identity crisis of most of people of the diaspora. They don't know if they're from the continent. They don't know if they're from Europe. And I'm like, listen, I'm both sides. And it's impossible to decide. It's like mixed race. You don't decide. You're both sides.
Baloji, do you see yourself as an emissary for change? I mean, would you like your music to achieve that, to make Congo a better place?
Wow. I think it needs more than music to make it a better place, unfortunately for us.
You're going to be in the United States pretty soon. You'll be performing at Global Fest in New York on Sunday. What would you like Americans to know about Congo?
Oh, so many things. But I think the main thing is like Congo is... I don't want to put myself like an ambassador of Congo. I just want to know that world music is a really cliche word. It doesn't mean anything.
A cliche, yeah.
Yeah. It's even more connected to some a view that you want to still look at Africa the way they used to be, like with the beautiful banana belt, some tam-tams and all this cliche. And I'm trying to say it's not just about that. And that's the beauty of the internet, for example. Internet is also in Africa. That means when something happens, when somebody has a comment, an opinion, a view, it doesn't just stay in Europe or in America. It's also in Africa. So we know. So the gap that we had the last 20 years don't exist anymore.
Congolese musician Baloji, that point he made about the internet connecting Africans to the rest of the world, it's a good one. Modern technology has improved many aspects of life in Africa, but sometimes it makes sense to keep things low-tech. Consider impoverished hospitals. Expensive machines that are donated or purchased often break down because there's no money and no ability to maintain the gear. Reporter Rowan Moore Garrity was in a rural part of Nigeria recently, and he met a surgeon who's found a clever way around those problems.
In a small farming town a few hours' drive from the city of Lagos, goats graze right outside the entrance of a low concrete building. It's the main hospital in Arua, Nigeria. Inside, in the maternity ward, mothers recline with their babies on worn, well-used beds. The hospital isn't fancy, but then it's not meant to be.
For me, it doesn't matter what it looks like, as long as it's functional.
Dr. Oloyombu Awojobi founded this hospital 27 years ago, and that pretty much sums up his philosophy. He's all about what works. What keeps the hospital running and growing are cheap, simple devices he designs and makes himself.
I'm using materials readily available in my backyard.
He shows me the clinic's operating table. You raise and lower it not with electronic controls, but with a jack, like the one you'd use to change a car tire. Then there's his blood centrifuge, a machine that separates plasma from red blood cells. It's made from used bike parts.
You put your capillary tubes in this holder.
You pedal with your hands, and it spins the blood sample as fast as the propeller on a small plane. The clinic suction pump, for removing blood and fluids during surgery, it's made from the valve on a bicycle inner tube and powered by pedaling. The hospital's boiler is made from an old propane tank. A worker keeps it running by shoveling in corn cobs collected from nearby farms. As the corn cobs burn, the boiler produces steam.
The steam operates the autoclave.
That's what sterilizes the surgical equipment. Because most of Awojobi's devices don't need electricity, the hospital doesn't have to rely on the town's unpredictable electrical grid or spend a lot of money running diesel generators when power is down. That keeps care at the hospital affordable to the farmers who make up its clientele. Delivering a baby costs $30. But Dr. Awojobi says there's another advantage to designing his own equipment.
Because I make it, I will know how to mend it. I don't have to depend on anybody else.
Dr. Awojobi has been asked to lecture on his inventions at medical conferences in India, Thailand, and the UK. The Nigerian government has given him awards as a surgeon and as an engineer. And among patients, his hospital has earned a national reputation for reliable, competent care. I met a patient named Bunmi Adams, who was here for fibroid surgery. She flew in from Abuja, Nigeria's capital.
Because I've heard a lot about Professor Awojobi, I decided on my own to come down here.
As for his inventions, Awojobi wants to make them as widely available as possible. He doesn't seek patents. Instead, he publishes his designs in international medical journals. But he's been frustrated that only a handful of other hospitals have adopted his devices. And why haven't his ideas been copied? Awojobi explains by reading a quote he keeps on his wall from the Renaissance philosopher Niccolo Machiavelli.
There is nothing more difficult to carry out, nor more doubtful of success, nor more dangerous to handle than to initiate a new order of things.
Dr. Awojobi says he's got another tactic to initiate his new order in medicine. He's taken on residents from a nearby medical school. Now he's training them to deliver his unusual style of high-quality care with low-tech equipment. For the world, I'm Rowan Moore Garrity, Arua, Nigeria.
You've got to see Dr. Awojobi's centrifuge made from bike parts. We've got animation and photos of his other inventions at PRI.org. And while you're there, you can chat with Dr. Awojobi. He'll be answering questions in the comments section below the story. Again, that's at PRI.org. Thanks to the International Reporting Project for providing support for our story from Nigeria. This next story is about a shoeshine man who became a beloved fixture in Sarajevo, the capital of Bosnia. Uncle Misho died on Monday at the age of 82. For decades, it was his job to polish the shoes of residents in Sarajevo. Apparently, he even kept on working when the war was raging in the 90s. Now people in Sarajevo want a statue erected in his memory. Elvira Jukic is a journalist in Sarajevo. She's been writing about Uncle Misho, or Chica Misho. Who was Uncle Misho? What was his real name? I don't think that's his real name.
His real name was Hussein Hassani, which barely anyone knew, even though everybody in Sarajevo, I don't know a person, I mean, you can always find one, but I don't know a person who doesn't know who was Chica Misho, you know? And nobody knew his name. I knew his name for the last couple of years, but not for always. Like, everybody knew him as Chica Misho, or as we could translate, Uncle Misho.
So what's his story? Where did he come from, and how did he end up with this kind of permanent position on the boulevards in Sarajevo, shining shoes?
He came to Sarajevo as a teenager with his family from from Kosovo. And there were 9 of them, brothers and sisters. And he came, they all came here to Sarajevo with their father and mother. And Misha used to say that he was training to, he was playing box. He wanted to be a boxer. Mm. And he was training box for 7 years and then realized that there is, he couldn't earn for a living playing this sport. And then when he was something around 20, he took over this job from his father, who was also a shoe shiner in Sarajevo. When they came, he said he came in 1946 to Sarajevo. So when he was 20, he took over this job, and as he said, he did it ever since he was 20, and he died in aged 82.
Right. Now, you met him several times. I guess it's impossible not to meet him. He's out there on the street every day, right?
Yeah. Actually took a photo of him 9 years ago or something like that. And I found that photo yesterday, and I published it within my article. And I was very glad that I found that photo, because it's an old photo which I took with an analog camera. So it's black and white. So it, you know, describes the moment with him.
Yeah, he looks very distinguished, I've got to say. I mean, he's a shoeshine man, but still.
In the last couple of years, he was always wearing a black coat and a man's hat, and he had those mustache, and he was always looking, you know, nicely dressed, and he was always smiling. I couldn't remember that I saw him once that he wasn't smiling.
And when you took that picture of him, I gathered he really wanted to be proper have your portrait be good.
Yeah, he wanted to kind of to pose. Like, he said something like, "Let me sit straightly. Now take a photo of me."
Elvira, is it true that he kept on shining shoes even when the war was raging in the 90s? And why did he do that?
Yeah, I wasn't here during the war. I mean, I was 4 when the war began, so I couldn't say by myself. But, you know, people who used to live in Sarajevo and also he said in many interviews that he was here in Sarajevo during the war, and he kept on coming every day. Because he didn't have anything else to do. And he also said that many people, even rich people and poor people, used to help him during the war, because he was in the main street, you know, sitting there every day. So, you know.
Now, he took the business of shining shoes over from his dad, and I gather his son is now going to keep the business going?
I'm not sure about that. But there's an interesting story about his daughter, whom he adopted. His wife found this baby more than 40 years ago near a garbage dump in the streets.
And abandoned.
And he said in one interview that his wife called him and said, "Misha, I found a pack of millions, like money." She wanted to say that she found a treasure. And he kept on saying that really was a treasure for him and his wife.
Wow, what an incredible story. And this is a humble shoeshine man who manages to pull off this incredibly generous thing.
Yeah.
Elvira Jukic, a journalist in Sarajevo, thanks very much for speaking with us about Uncle Misha. Really appreciate it.
Thanks to you, too.
You're listening to The World from Public Radio International.
The World is brought to you by PRI, with help from Lookout. Lookout is dedicated to helping protect people and businesses from mobile threats, including device loss, malware, and spyware. You can download the Lookout app for Android and iPhone today. Learn more at lookout.com.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. The Winter Olympic Games in Sochi, Russia, are less than a month away now. Opening ceremonies are on February 7th, although the first events are scheduled to start on the 6th. One of those first events is actually new to the Winter Olympics. It's team figure skating. Yep. In addition to their individual events, some figure skaters will compete as part of teams representing their nations. 10 countries, including Russia and the U.S., are in the running for a team medal. Josh Ellis of American Figure Skating says this new event is already generating a lot of buzz.
Not only am I excited, but all of the athletes are excited for 10 nations to come together and each have a man, a lady, a pairs team, and an ice dance couple go out there and perform as a team. This is similar to the gymnastics team event, where athletes will compete by themselves to get a score. And those scores will be added together, and then the top 3 teams with the highest scores will receive Olympic medals.
Team gymnastics is always pretty popular with American viewers. I'm sure NBC is hoping for something similar here. Another new event getting its debut in Sochi is slope-style snowboarding. And there's also slope-style skiing. For those not in the know, slope-style is like totally inspired by skateboarding, with athletes doing wild tricks while they maneuver rails and jumps. Ray Bevere with the American Association of Snowboard Instructors says these events will definitely have high entertainment value.
So you're going to see kids going off enormous jumps. You'll see double back flips. You'll see cork maneuvers, which is an off-axis flip. You'll see kids on rails, which are great big metal or plastic boxes that they slide on their gear. And you'll see a couple of really bad crashes. I think sometimes that's what people gravitate towards, just to watch the crash. But everyone really needs to take a look at the athleticism in there. These guys are amazing.
Other newcomers to the Winter Olympic scene, like women's ski jumping and half-pipe skiing, also promise to be fun to watch. And that's the point, says Steve Zajcik. He writes about Olympic TV coverage for the LA Times, and he says these adrenalized Winter Olympic events could help the Sochi Games reach new audiences.
I think generally the idea here is to create competitions that are just going to bring in younger viewers. There's a feeling that as hair-raising as some of these things are, as some of these competitions are, the Olympics tend to garner an older audience. If you bring in things like snowboarding, add more snowboarding events, more of these kind of daredevil events, you're going to see a somewhat younger demographic, and that's what they're going for.
And speaking of hair raising winter sports stories, former basketball star Dennis Rodman visited a ski resort in North Korea today. It was part of his controversial trip this week to the rogue Stalinist nation, a trip that I'm sure you've heard also included this.
Happy birthday to you.
Rodman there doing his best Marilyn Monroe for North Korea's leader, Kim Jong-un. Rodman's birthday gift to Kim was a bizarre hoops game, starring himself and a bunch of other NBA retirees, versus a North Korean team. The North Koreans won, by the way. We wondered what real impact, good or bad, Rodman's self-styled basketball diplomacy is having. So we called Nicholas Burns. He knows a thing or two about diplomacy and basketball. Burns is a former top State Department official and ambassador. He also teaches at Harvard's Kennedy School and is a basketball junkie. So, Nick, this is Rodman's fourth trip to North Korea. What do you make of all this?
Well, I must say, I find this whole episode of Dennis Rodman embracing one of the most brutal dictators in the world, frankly, disgraceful. It's very ill-advised, and I think it's a mistake that's going to stay with Rodman for a very long time, because he's making a basic mistake here. He's overlooking and disregarding the brutality of a dictator.
Based on what you know about Dennis Rodman, does this surprise you? I mean, it's really the first time he's ever taken any political stand, it seems.
I don't know him personally. He was obviously a great basketball player for the Chicago Bulls. He was a big part of their success in the 90s, but he's really betrayed, I think, some real ignorance of politics in East Asia. And he's making a mistake that's hurting the United States. And Marco, I contrast this with, say, the ping pong diplomacy with China.
Right. I was going to ask you about that, because Jesse Jackson on CNN yesterday compared this basketball diplomacy to ping pong in China, or the Harlem Globetrotters going to the Soviet Union and whistling Sweet Georgia Brown. And he pointed out no one really knew at the time how those efforts would work. So do you think people are not being open-minded enough about what Rodman might actually achieve, unwittingly even?
I think that he's gone to a place that he shouldn't go with the North Koreans, and he contrasts it with what the ping pong diplomacy accomplished with China. When the American national ping pong team went to China in the early 1970s, we had not had diplomatic relations with the Chinese for 20 years. They broke the ice. It was sports diplomacy. And it was a very important event that began to allow the Chinese and Americans to talk to each other. But the U.S. team did not embrace Mao. But they did do something important. They were apolitical. The line that Dennis Rodman has crossed is that he's become political. And he has essentially thrown his support, his personal support, to one of the most odious figures in modern politics. So I don't think it's right to say that what he's doing is somehow in the tradition of some of the people in the past who have done a lot of good by breaking down barriers through sports.
How much is this freaking out the North Korea specialists at the State Department? I mean, I would guess that it's got to be tantalizing on one hand because of the promise that somehow Rodman might open the tap to new information about a place we know little about. But then again, it's totally unpredictable, isn't it?
Well, there always is that possibility that he might find something out about the personality or the personal life of Kim Jong-un that could possibly be useful at the State Department, because this is a very opaque regime. But the United States does have the capacity to talk to the North Korean government. We do that regularly. We don't usually at all agree with them. But there isn't an absence of communications that Dennis Rodman needs to fix.
Nick, on a practical note, can any American citizen travel anywhere they want, assuming they have the proper visa and arrangements with the destination country? I mean, is there ever a situation where the State Department would say, for example, no, you can't and you will not go to North Korea?
Yes, there have been times in the past several decades, where the United States government, many administrations have said that American citizens are not permitted to travel to a certain country, and for very good reasons. He apparently has arranged his visas to North Korea. I don't think the State Department has objected on those grounds, but I think they've objected quite rightly and wisely on political grounds. I think the State Department would like to see American citizens do the right thing when they travel, and this is clearly not the right thing to excuse a dictatorship.
Nick Burns, thanks so much for your thoughts.
Thank you.
Dennis Rodman's not the only American to drop in on the Hermit Kingdom in recent weeks. Remember Peso and Pac-Man? They're the two D.C.-based rappers who raised more than $10,000 on Kickstarter to make a video in Pyongyang. Well, they did it, and now their video is out. Escaping no career, another murder zone. 007 on the mission, feel like James Bond. They say it's called Escape to North Korea, and it's pretty good. It shows the two of them in scenes around Pyongyang, in front of the massive communist monuments, on public transit, bundling up in the snow. The scenes are all pretty quick, like they didn't want to attract too much attention. We've got the video on our website, PRI.org, where you can also find our original story on the duo. That'll do it for us today. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We're back tomorrow. Gotta get it. Go get it. We taking off. Great escape to North Korea. Feeling in the zone. Talk all the crazy. Must say we don't know what's going on. What goes around, comes around. The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, Public Radio International, and WGBH Boston, supported in part by the Luce Foundation's Henry R. Luce Initiative on Religion and International Affairs, by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world, macfound.org, by the Annenberg Foundation, and by the WGBH Fund for Environmental Reporting, whose donors include the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment, supporting a cooperative approach to solving our critical environmental problems while we still can, and by the PRI Global Reporting Fund, providing in-depth reporting on a diverse array of important topics, including global health. Donors to the fund include Marguerite Steed Hoffman and Blythe Brendan Mann Foundation.
PRI, Public Radio International.